You're listening to the Ruhi Sleep, Sleep in Society podcast, recorded in Kingston, Ontario, Canada.
Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Sleep in Society. And we are recording now remotely, which is a brand new thing for me because usually I'm at the studio at CFRC. And today I have a very special guest with me, and it's Tara Kaner. Tara is a member of Justice, Peace and Integrity of Creation Office of Sisters of Providence of St. Vincent de Paul in Kingston, and a longtime advocate for the rights and services for the poor. Welcome, Tara, to Sleep in Society podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for joining me. I'm very proud to have you because I've been reading a lot about you, and it's incredibly impressive what you have been doing within our community here and the service you've been doing to our community, and especially as to the poor. May I please ask you to give us a little bit of your history, which, by the way, is fascinating and inspiring.
Well, okay. It's hard to know where to begin.
Wherever you feel.
Well, how do I feel?
Well, no, wherever you feel like it's a good start. Oh, yes,
I see. Okay. Well, I suppose I've always had a bent towards social justice because of the family I grew up in. And talk around the dinner table was always about the state of the world and oftentimes how unfair it is to the most vulnerable and powerless. And so I just kind of grew up with that lens of the world. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you're young and you just think things are going to unfold as they should and you'll have a successful career and a family and, you know, plenty of money, mm-hmm. and all of that. And then life throws you a few curves. So I guess the first really big curve in my life was after coming to Kingston. I grew up in Saskatchewan and I moved here in 1988 to start a PhD in English literature in the Queens. Mm-hmm. And I did well academically that first year, although I had many barriers in my way. I was a single parent of three children. Two of them were under the age of six. And my oldest was 12 years old.
Oh,
and
my.
They went to different schools and different daycares. And I had no car. And the transportation system in Kingston at the time was absolutely appalling. So just getting basic bus service to go anywhere was a trial. And
how did you manage, if you don't mind my interruption here, how did you manage to be a single parent and take these kids everywhere where they needed your kids, where they needed to go, and then
We walked mostly because the bus took longer than walking. So if we could possibly walk anywhere, that's what we did. Otherwise, I tried to rely on the bus system, which was very unreliable at the time. So it was indeed frustrating. I literally spent half my day just taking kids places and picking them up. And because my oldest son was 12, in the evening, I lived in Anclack in the family mm-hmm. housing for Queens. There was a study room in the basement of my building. My oldest son would watch the two younger ones while I went downstairs and did my homework and studied. And I was highly, highly motivated to succeed at, you know, getting a PhD. Unfortunately, all of the logistical nightmares defeated me after about the first year and a half or so.
Can we talk a little bit about that?
Well, I as I mentioned, I did well academically. Mm-hmm. I was awarded a SHRC grant, a Social Sciences and Humanities Research grant, which, you know, were more money than any other kind of grant you mm-hmm. could get. And So that was nice, and that was helpful. But I mean, basically, I had no savings. I didn't have any money to speak of. So, you know, aside from all the logistical barriers, finances were a barrier as well. But anyway, so after the end of the first year, because I had responsibilities for a family, I couldn't spend 18 hours a day on my studies, as seemed to be expected of me. So at the end of the first year, which was all coursework, I ended up with 3 outstanding papers, which I needed to finish before I wrote comprehensive exams, which were in the fall. I did ask if I could defer those exams until the spring, so I had time to finish those papers and mm-hmm. still study, and I was told absolutely not. I would be bringing down academic standards if I did something like that.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it was very disappointing. I was very stressed out. I did my best. I finished one paper. I still had 2 more to go, and I was trying to study and look after kids all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was there in English, there are 2 sets of exams. I did fine. In fact, I think I did pretty well on the first set, and I completely bombed the second set. If you don't pass both sets, you don't pass your comprehensive exams. So I, you know.
Yeah.
I was told that I could rewrite them in the spring, and I considered that. What I ended up doing was, at the time, there was a dean of women at Queen's, which has disappeared, but at the time, and she talked to me, and she said, well, why don't you take a year's leave of absence and see how things go, and, you know, then you could come back. So that's what I did, but it, you know, I still felt, at the end of that year, I was still exhausted. I was still stressed out. I still have, you know, children to raise. Mm-hmm. And I just decided at that point that I would not continue.
And then what did you move into after that?
Well, I tried to raise my family and have enough money to keep a roof over our heads and food on the table. I had 2 undergraduate degrees as well as a master's degree. I thought, you know, that was education enough to find a job somewhere. I was able to get some short-term contract freelance kinds of jobs. I had a couple of professors who I got to know at Queen's who threw work my way anytime they could, which was very good of them. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if you've ever tried to do freelance work, probably because you're doing this podcast. It does not pay well.
Doesn't pay at all.
Okay, yours doesn't pay at all.
No.
And it's any income you do get is poor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a lot of income. And it's very erratic, so you never know whether you're going to have work or not.
Well, yeah.
So I tried to do that for a while. I also had some, you know, small part-time jobs. My two youngest children were in elementary school, so I was playground supervisor, lunchtime supervisor, and I did little jobs like that. But mm-hmm. as I say, it didn't all add up to anything much.
And go ahead.
So after about a year of just trying to make ends meet and get increasingly frustrated and stressed out, I decided my only option was going to be to apply for social welfare. So that's what I did.
And we had off the record conversation about this, mm-hmm. about the stigma that comes with social welfare. And you being highly educated, how did that affect, you know, you said you were very motivated as an individual mm-hmm. wanting to finish your PhD and wanting to do while raising children, which is incredible, by the way. PhD on its own is a hard thing to do, but while trying to raise 3 children is just, I don't know, is an Annapurna of what I would call mountains, which is one of the toughest climbs.
Unfortunately, that's how it was. Now, I had done a master's degree with 3 children as mm-hmm. well as a single parent, and one was an infant when I did my master's degree. And the attitude of my university in Regina, Saskatchewan, was so different from the attitude at Queen's. I remember the first week I arrived in Kingston, I went to Queen's to introduce myself to the Department of English. And the woman in the office said, well, I don't know what you think you're doing. You're not going to succeed. So that was pretty much their attitude from the beginning, that I had too much on my plate and I shouldn't even bother to try. Whereas the attitude from my previous university was so encouraging.
Why do you think that difference? What was so different about Queens?
Saskatchewan is very different from Ontario. When I first came here, I almost felt like I was in a foreign country. Saskatchewan has changed immensely in the past 30 years, and I've been here 30 years, a little bit more than that now. But at the time, people were much more accepting, I think. Things like status and income didn't brand you as a particular type of person that, you know, and locked you into a particular sphere of existence.
Stamped your identity.
People, it was much more fluid. People wouldn't judge you so much on your appearance, you know. When I came here, the first question was, what do you do? That was another question that actually in Saskatchewan, as I grew up, didn't come up that often. It was, how are you?
Amazing. Yeah. The difference. And how interesting that you have these two different perspectives, and how shocking it must have been. How does one deal with something like that? If you're coming from something, a place that is all accepting, they're looking at you and they're not judging you on what you are doing more than who you are as a human being, and then coming to a place where you are saying, oh, what do you do? And then we'll make the judgment accordingly.
Mm-hmm. And also how you look. Another big thing.
Yeah, indeed.
I've never been into fashion. It doesn't concern me.
Yeah.
But I found I was judged very often by my, the very first impression I made was the one that seemed to stick with people. And often it was based on, you know, how I look and what did I do. I did find it a very difficult adjustment. So it was bewildering to me. And I also found that university people were extremely competitive. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Whereas at University of Regina, where I did my undergraduate degrees and my master's degree, we were pretty cooperative. We tried to help each other out as much as we could. We wouldn't rush to the library and take all the books out on a particular subject because we'd been assigned a paper. Queen's students did that kind of thing. It was absolutely amazing to me.
Wow. Seems like a rather a very individualistic approach rather than a collective one.
Yes.
Rather than thinking that, you know, we need to collectively work on something to have that level of self-centeredness, which is very much part of like our, this kind of capitalistic neoliberal ideology that's happening.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. And I suppose because Saskatchewan, you know, was agricultural based for so long and the climate there is so harsh, you know, we really do depend on others for your survival
in
some cases.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, in broad general terms, I think you're right. There was a collective sensibility in Saskatchewan and a very individualistic one in Ontario when I came. And so how did I deal with that? Well, I found a friend who was from Alberta, not quite Saskatchewan, but we did have much more similar backgrounds and sensibilities than I found with other students there at Queen's.
So you tried to find your tribe within here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you were on social welfare for, may I ask, for how long?
Yeah, well, I think I got on to social assistance in the end of 1992, maybe, and I managed to exit the system in the year 2000 when I got a job that paid me well enough to allow me to exit the system.
And then you started studying the system. You were studying the system, I suppose, the entire time you were in it.
Yeah, well, I mean, my academic work was in English literature. Yes, when I fell into poverty, it was very isolating. It was very depressing. Mm-hmm. And I felt, okay, I have two choices. I can sit at home and feel really badly about what's happened and who I am now, or I can, you know, seek others in similar circumstances and we can try to sort this out together. So that's the approach I took. I did happen to see, there was a little newspaper at the time, community newspaper called Neighbor to Neighbor, which was out of the north end of Kingston. Mm-hmm. And there was a little ad in it saying, now this was at the time of still the NDP government under Bob Rae. It said, yes. The NDP government is considering changes to the welfare system. If this concerns you, come to a meeting. So that's how I met other people who were also on social assistance and were interested in doing what they could to improve it. And that's where it started. So out of that, we started an anti-poverty group. Mm-hmm. It was modeled pretty much on OCAP, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, which does a lot of direct action. Meaning, you know, actively helping people navigate their way through the various systems.
May I ask how how OCAP does that, just so people have a little bit of an understanding how these organizations work, because this is not just analysis, this is praxis.
Yeah, well, OCAP, you know, did things probably in a much bigger and more radical way than we did, being from Kingston. Mm-hmm. But basically, the direct action part of what we tried to do was we set ourselves up as a little group, and eventually we got an office so that people knew where they could find us. We had a phone number so people could call us, and we advertised ourselves as offering hands-on assistance with whatever they needed help with, whether it was applying for social assistance or employment insurance or you know, going to the food bank or whatever.
Navigating the bureaucracies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yeah, basically.
Yeah. How long did this group go on? Is it still active?
No, it's not. It went for about 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And we did all the other things that community activists do. You know, we wrote letters, we wrote articles, we organized demonstrations, we joined demonstrations mostly in Toronto with other groups. You know, we talked to politicians, you know, we did all of those kinds of things as well.
So these are very interesting times at the moment that we are in. Mm-hmm. And incredibly challenging, especially because, you know, over 15% of the Kingston population is under $20,000. And I'm pretty sure that number is about to rise significantly. Mm-hmm. Because of joblessness at the moment and everybody being isolated. How difficult do you think it's going to be to navigate, especially for the poor in our community who are not educated, who don't have access to this kind of information, through these incredibly challenging times?
It's going to be very difficult for people, you know, at least in the old days of mm-hmm. the early 90s after, you know, Premier Mike Harris came to power and, you know, knocked poor people down as much as he possibly could. At least we could gather together. We could have, you know, potlucks together, we could talk together, we could go out together, mm-hmm. We could accompany people to the various offices they needed to go to. Right now, everybody's in isolation. You cannot do that. Mm-hmm. So everything now is trying to be organized remotely. I'm currently with a tenants group called the Cataraqui Kingston Union of Tenants. Mm-hmm. And tomorrow night we are going to try to have a workshop on Zoom and see how that's going to go. We'll, you know, have people online who have various levels of expertise about housing and mm-hmm. tenancies, and we'll be asking people to check in with questions. I have no idea how that's going to go.
It's a brand new landscape, literally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so abrupt. It wasn't even like a gradual shift. I mean, it was building up for quite a while if we look at it in terms of, you know, we've been using Band-Aids for a failing yes. infrastructure, whether it's our education, yeah. whether it's our healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely.
And those things are now falling apart, and we don't actually know what the short-term or even long-term consequences are going to be.
No, we don't.
So, which brings me to the subject of universal guaranteed income. May I please ask you to give us a little insight into this for so the public can understand what it actually means? And this is not, we're not talking about like a welfare system. This is a whole, it's a different concept altogether.
It's a very different concept. And what it, you know, it does mean different things to different people around the world. I'm a member of the Basic Income Canada Network. I'm on their board, actually. Mm-hmm. And I'm a member of the Kingston Action Group for a Basic Income Guarantee. And our understanding of a basic income is guaranteed cash transfers from the government to individuals. And it provides enough income for everyone to meet their basic needs and live with dignity. And that's whether they work or whether they don't work.
And how do we, and this is what was very interesting, because these are conversations I've had previously with a lot of people, whether they are labor historians, labor lawyers, union organizers, is how do we define in terms of dignity? What does that mean? Because it's not just enough for humanity to just basically survive. I mean, the point of us is a civilization in the First Nation. Like this is a developed nation. We are the members of G7. We're members of G20. What does it mean in terms of dignity?
Well, I think that's a fluid question, and it's probably different for every single individual who's involved. What we want to see is an income that is sufficient to bring people above the poverty line. And a basic income, unlike welfare, you can improve your circumstances to a fairly good degree by providing yourself with more work if you can or if you desire to do that. So, again, it would be an individual decision whether you want to live above the poverty line and you can cope with that and you want to pursue a particular art or craft or a business, or you want to be a community activist and not work at paid labor on top of that. So it would depend on different people, but it definitely has to be enough income to bring a person above the poverty line so that they're not constantly stressed and worried about whether they can eat that month or pay their rent or mortgage or put food on the table.
So if we were to take the scenario back to when you were doing your PhD and apply that and say, if you had access to that level of income, your reality would have been very different for the next little while.
It would have been very different, yes.
Mm-hmm. I think the idea of basic income is also really important because I think it would allow us to be able to thrive as human beings, to be able to pursue, be innovators, be creators, to seek knowledge and to be able to do it. And we had this conversation briefly a couple of days ago on the phone where we're saying there are always going to be people who are not, who just are, right? And that's okay too.
Yes.
If people don't want to have pursuits or ambitions, or that's fine. Not everybody needs to have ambitions in life. Not everybody needs to be. And that should be also be acceptable, because I think the idea as to why we don't have that is because we are under this impression that it's going to make us lazy, which I don't think is the case at all.
No, and there's lots of evidence to show that it's not
there is,
the case
yeah.
at all. And that's another central feature of basic income, is that it broadens the definition of work. When we say work, most people think of paid work in the labor force.
Mm-hmm.
When a person who believes in basic income says work, they mean everything from raising children, looking after an elderly parent, working on a craft or an art, or experimenting with different things to see how they all turn out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's human beings work. That's in our nature.
Yeah.
And what basic income has proven to show in different places around the world, and most recently in Ontario with the basic income pilot project, which the Conservative government terminated 2 years early, is that basic income gives people an edge. It gives them enough so that they can stop thinking about the day-to-day necessities and be totally frantic about them. It gives them a chance to take a breath, to have hope, to look into the future and think, okay, now I can think about moving to a better place.
Yeah,
the place I live in is horrid.
It levels the playing field, so to speak, because, you know, if we look at unpaid work that you as a single parent did, there was, I think, this was an article, I always confuse the two, either New York Times or The Atlantic,
mm-hmm.
which was looking at the unpaid labor that women are doing, whether they're caregivers looking after their children. And this is actually focused very much on women and not like, because women actually have multiple jobs. We have our jobs where we get paid, and then we have our other jobs in terms of like looking after children and being the organizers, being the caregivers. So in the United States, they were looking at it, and at the minimum wage, it would have, women would have been paid around $15 trillion last year alone in unpaid labor that they have to do. And when we're looking at gross domestic product, that income is not taken into account.
No, it's not. And there was a woman some many years ago, Marilyn Waring out of New Zealand, who wrote a book just about all of that, mm-hmm. that if only women's labor was taken into account in the way we figure out what our country's GDP is, it would just change the landscape.
It would change the economic landscape for sure.
Yeah.
This Ontario project you were talking about, the basic income project, can we go a little bit into that
mm-hmm.
as to what it discovered and how it was who initiated it and what it involved?
Well, there are a lot of people in Ontario who have been working on implementing a basic income guarantee for quite a long time. And those people, at the end of the Liberal tenancy, or whatever you would call it, when they were towards the end of their tenure mm-hmm. as a party in power, they could see that they were losing favor, and basic income was something that people had argued for through their entire, you know, 14 years in power. But it was only at the end where the premier agreed that she would try something like that. And mm-hmm. I think it was a last-ditch attempt to do some, you know, very important progressive moves in Ontario to keep hold of power. So she agreed to implement a basic income guarantee for targeted populations in Ontario. So basically that was around Hamilton
mm-hmm.
And Thunder Bay and Lindsay, Ontario. And it was not $2,000 a month, as we're kind of suggesting would be more optimal, but it did provide people with 75% of what people were calling for a basic income guarantee. And Hugh Siegel, the former conservative senator, was instrumental in helping them set that up.
How was this funded? Do we know? It always comes down to, it's going to be like, you know, there's always going to be this question as to who is funding this? Where is this money coming from?
Yes. Well, you're right. Those are the two, you know, central objections to basic income. One, people won't work. And the second is that we can't afford it. Well, Basic Income Canada Network, mm-hmm. which is a national organization that studies basic income and advocates for it, recently put together a policy paper called I forget the exact title, but it's known as the policy options paper. Mm-hmm. And what that did was look at three different models for basic income. Mm-hmm. And it gave basically an income of about $22,000 a year per individual. And it looked at three different ways of implementing it based on the resources that we have within our Canadian system right now. So they weren't looking for any extra money outside of that, just shuffling the way our system works now. They showed that we could implement basic income in three different ways if we wanted to. Mm-hmm. So one included everyone, called a universal basic income.
Yes.
So everyone would get a certain amount of money, and in this case, $22,000 per individual above anybody above 18 mm-hmm. would receive that. Because of the child tax benefit, which operates something like a basic income, they would leave that in place and leave it alone. And then the other two models.
The child tax benefit would be on, would remain in place regardless
whether you're
receiving. Okay.
Yes. And then there are two other models. One included everybody above the age of 18. And then the other one didn't figure in seniors because, again, the old age security and the GIS, guaranteed income supplement, that if you're low income as a senior, you would receive. They figured that, again, functioned like a kind of basic income. So they'd leave that in place and not include people under the age of 64 in that model. But what they showed was that all three are feasible mm-hmm. and they're affordable. So that's the important thing.
And why do you think, why are we so hesitant in terms of implementing this when we know this would elevate our society, it would elevate our citizens, and it would likely create incredible amount of innovation and creativity and free us from the burdens of just, you know, trying to just survive.
Absolutely. And, you know, even though the Ontario pilot only lasted a year, that's exactly what it showed. It freed people. I think the most significant factor of a basic income or characteristic of basic income is that it stabilizes your life. You know that you have a certain amount of income and it's going to come in regularly. It's not going to stop and start, and you're not going to have to worry about whether you can count on it or not, because it's going to be there. Mm-hmm. And that really freed people to, as I said previously, to have hope and to think into the future. When poverty basically means you have absolutely no options. You can't think about improving your life because you don't have the resources to improve your life. And a basic income showed people that they had that ability. And yes, and far from people not doing anything and just sitting at home and putting their feet up, it motivated people to do all kinds of creative work and paid work and volunteerism.
Yeah, it's, you know, because I think we are constantly, as human beings, seeking meaning and seeking purpose, whether
Absolutely.
It's like in terms of our work or whether in terms of creativity or any kind. And we are actually, that's part of our DNA. That's part of our, you know, evolution. Why are we so hesitant, Tara, about implementing this when we know, and this is not the only experiment in Ontario. There have been experiments in New Brunswick. There have been experiments done in Finland, Sweden, USA. All of these countries have been experimenting with this idea of universal basic income. And what is stopping us?
I think it's largely ideological.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because I've just started Thomas Piketty's book, Capital and Ideology. Mm-hmm. And one of the statements he makes is that inequality is not economical. It's not technological. It's political and it's ideological.
Yes, I would agree with that. And if we look back to Mike Harris and the Conservative government that followed the NDP in 1995, he wanted a scapegoat. The poor people were his first target. And then, of course, he went, he kept on and, penalizing Aboriginal people and people of color and women and anybody who was vulnerable at all. He targeted.
Why? What was it? What are they protecting?
Privilege.
Indeed. for the few.
Mm-hmm.
How?
Yes.
Right now, in this as we are in the midst of this pandemic, and our government is trying to make sense of everything, and I have to say that they are stepping up in some ways. How difficult do you think it's going to be, even though they have announced all these stimulus packages and everything? How accessible is all this stuff going to be for the people of Canada at the moment?
I don't think any of us knows, and that is a question that we'll learn in time. In Ontario as well, I mentioned I'm in this tenants group and we've been told there's a moratorium on evictions. Don't worry if you don't pay your rent. Doug Ford came out and said, if it's a choice between having food to eat or paying your rent, well, don't pay your rent. What does that mean? What are the consequences going to be if people say, okay, I'm not going to pay my rent? There's a moratorium on evictions. Will landlords even hear that, or will they continue to try to evict people and make their lives miserable even though there's a moratorium on evictions? These are some of the questions we'll probably consider tomorrow when we have our Zoom community meeting about this situation. But nobody knows. Nobody knows how easy it's going to be to access all these programs that the federal government has been announcing. I think the positive side of that is that the government is offering financial aid to people at this very precarious and terrifying time.
Mm-hmm.
And they could have gone in the opposite direction, and they haven't. So that's encouraging. And this, benefit that the federal government announced just a couple of days ago, the Canada Emergency Response Benefit, or CERB as it's being known, offers $2,000 a month, which is around the same amount that a basic income would offer. Now, it is being offered to people who won't be eligible for employment insurance, who may have to be working from home and consequently aren't getting paid, who may have positive symptoms of COVID-19 and aren't able to go out to work.
Mm-hmm. So are their caregivers and looking after sick and the elderly at home and have children. Small children, single mothers who have nowhere to put their children.
So it does cover some of those people who are going to fall through the cracks otherwise. Mm-hmm. One of the questions, though, is will it cover immigrants? Will it cover, refugees who don't have status? That's a very, very important group to protect as well, but we don't know.
Especially if you're not aware of all of those things and you don't understand the language. And you don't have access to that either.
Yeah.
And you're isolated. It's not like you can go to an office and go, hey, I don't know what's going on. Like even with here, Keys is closed, right? Unless you knew that or you know somebody. How do you connect with all these people?
No, you're right. Mm-hmm. And we're totally dependent on technology right now.
Yeah. And what
for communication.
Yeah. And what if people don't have access to Wi-Fi? What if they don't have computers? Like, I think that's what these are the questions that I've been thinking about a lot lately.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely that new benefit, the CERB benefit, there's going to be a portal on a computer, apparently, for people to plug into to apply. You're right. Not everybody has a computer. One thing I noticed, I have a dog, so I have to take her out for walks. And one thing I noticed was on telephone poles, there was a whole list of community services available. And I thought, well, that's really helpful because it showed where you can get emergency groceries. Mm-hmm. It showed where you can ask somebody to deliver groceries to you. It showed a number of very important services where you can go get tested if you think you might have COVID-19. And there it was on a telephone pole to be read. So yeah. That people are walking around, which no one is supposed to be doing right now. We're all supposed to be staying home. But that, you know, somebody has thought, okay, not everybody has the computer. Not everybody's going to know this information. So at least we can put it out there.
Yeah, what an act. What a thoughtful act. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that it would be, because we don't know how long we are in this for. And we don't know, you know, the impact, how it's going to hit our economy and what's going to happen when the 4-month period ends.
No, we don't. And you know, again, when you hear Trudeau come out every day at 11:30 or whatever it is.
11 o'clock. Between 11 and 11:15, I think. That's the Prime Minister comes out, yeah.
Now, he's made the point many times that everything is in flux. They're open to change. You know, if they need to put in more devices or programs to protect people, they're willing to do that. So yeah. We'll see.
Wouldn't this be a good time to just get going on universal basic income?
Yes, everyone is saying that. There are many, if you go again to the Basic Income Canada Network website, there's a whole list of articles from people in Canada and elsewhere in the world saying now is a really important time to implement the mm-hmm. Basic Income Guarantee.
I mean, we're a country that is rich in resources and, you know, it would be a wonderful thing for our citizens to be able to have access to that so we can be innovators, we can be creators, we can be explorers without having to worry about if we're going to have food, where are we going to live, if we're going to have, you know, basic medical attention, which we do at this particular point because our healthcare system is somewhat adequate. Mm-hmm. But we don't know. But at the same time, we have made significant cuts to our healthcare system and our education, mm-hmm. significant cuts recently, and we have no idea about the implications of that in the long term if we're looking at it.
No, that's right. And people are calling for basic income now to get us through this crisis of the COVID-19, but also for it to remain mm-hmm. into the future so that we can restabilize our lives and get back to some kind of normalization of life. But what we don't want to see is a return to the days of neoliberalism that we've just, you know, coming out of right now.
We are right, like, I think, in the middle of it. This idea, yes. This conversation I had with Jeremy Milloy, we were talking about it's even post-neoliberalism. I was like, wait a minute, I just got to neoliberalism. We've already moved post-neoliberalism. My dear Tara, I'm so glad. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm wondering if you'll be open to coming back and we can have a further conversation. We always want to leave a door open because we know these are very complex issues and complex subject concepts. And so we always want to leave a door open for further conversations.
I'd be very happy to. And I hope when I come back, if I come back, I can say, great, we have a basic income.
And we can do it face to face, which I would very much appreciate.
Yes, that would be lovely.
Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Ruhi Sleep, Sleep and Society podcast, available on ruhisleep.ca. Don't forget to follow us on social media @ruhisleep on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you for listening.